This is the 343 Podcast. I'm your host, John Pronich. Welcome to the show. Today, we are going to dive a bit more into the topic of soccer IQ. Because while correct decisions on the field are sometimes governed by the current scoreline or the run of play, or the opposition, or the time on the clock, what most people fail to realize is the most fundamental guide. That the correct decision, by and far, is the one that retains possession. Now, that's generally speaking, but all decisions to the contrary are typically risks. Trying to dribble by a player or two or three, threading a pass to your midfielders or strikers, launching a 40-yard ball to your forwards. What are you risking when you do those types of things? Well, you're risking a turnover and wasting what would have been a much better opportunity 2, 5, or even 30 passes later. So today, we are going to discuss soccer IQ. Gary Kleiben joins me for this conversation, and it's a lively one, so I hope that you enjoy it. And we'll get right into this conversation after a quick message about our online coaching program. Thank you so much for being with us. When it comes to coaching education, being able to discern what will and won't help you can be costly and confusing. The internet is flooded with so much information. There are tons of drills out there for you to watch and tons of things that you can try with your players and teams. But without the proper context and the proper guidance from a legit mentor, you are not going to get the edge that you are looking for or the results that you want. That's what the 343 Premium Coaching Education Program gets right. It's rooted in the real experiences of a master practitioner that has coached soccer right here in America. As a coach, Brian Kleiben has been able to overcome all of the obstacles and produce college-level, professional, and international caliber players. Training just twice per week, field congestion, pay-to-play, you name it. But using the 343 framework and staying consistent with the methodology has led to tremendous success. What the 343 coaching program offers you is a look at Brian's actual work, his real art. It's all captured and delivered to you in its purest form to help you gain an advantage and become a better coach. This exclusive online program features videos of Brian mic'd up during actual training sessions with his real players and teams as they prepare for league games and tournaments. This is the only program in the country that gives you this type of authentic, behind-the-curtain look at player, team, and coach development. It's unlike anything else in this country. It cannot be replicated, and it's not theory or speculation like you'd see in a presentation or something staged like you'd get at a convention. So if you're looking for drills, we've got those, but more importantly, we have the mentorship, the proven results, and the community of ambitious coaches that you won't find anywhere else. To experience all of this, consider joining the 343 Premium Coaching Education Program. You can find all of the details at 343coaching.com. So soccer IQ is something that you, a phrase that you started using to discuss, you know, decision-making basically when it comes to a number of different things that a player must do on the field. So, and I think in another interview, you actually said that you may or may not have actually coined the term soccer IQ. And now it's used not prevalently, but it's definitely used often. And just some general thoughts on where this came from and what got you thinking about soccer IQ. And then we can kind of go from there.
Yeah. I have no idea why I started using the term. Maybe I got it from somewhere else, but I don't remember that. All I can say for sure is that we've always thought about a player's game intelligence or intelligence period. But instead of just saying this player is smart, this player is dumb, I think it was a little bit more diplomatic and accurate to be able to talk about their soccer intelligence versus just flat out intelligence. For instance, Diego Maradona, I don't think it's that controversial to say that, you know, his general intelligence. I mean, he's not a rocket scientist, if that's what we're if that's what we're thinking about, you know, generally speaking, but his soccer intelligence is definitely well up there. So that we had to come up with some sort of differentiating factor, and hence the term soccer IQ made sense to me. And I started using it a lot in you know, what I wrote and the way I spoke about the game. I don't know, 10 years ago, 11 years ago, 12 years ago, 15 years ago, I really don't know. And then it did seem to kind of become more and more prevalent over the years, to the point where we're at now, where a lot of people kind of have heard of the term, use it themselves, and now I don't even like the term anymore. But yeah, I think that's kind of like the origin story of that. But like you said, it's generally about decision making on the field, decision making when you're on the ball, decision making when you're off the ball. And off the ball can be when your team is in possession, or it can be when your team is not in possession. So through the different phases of the game, what actions are you taking? Are you taking good actions, good decisions, or poor ones? And, you know, there's a list of examples that we can go through to kind of illuminate what is a good versus bad decision.
Yeah. So what would be something, you know, with the ball that would be a decision that a player has to make? And then what would make that decision good or bad, or correct or incorrect?
So I wrote an article a while back, and I kind of, you know, the article was meant to introduce the topic and make it a recommendation that people can follow and maybe start, you know, venturing into this field of soccer IQ or good versus bad decision making. And the claim that I made was, generally speaking, if you're on the ball, the smartest decision is the one that retains possession. So meaning you better not be the one, generally speaking, who is producing a turnover. And the turnover could be by, I don't know, trying to execute a high risk pass that gets intercepted, or you just don't have the technical ability to execute it. So why are you taking that sort of high risk pass versus a low risk pass, which, or a lower risk pass, which retains possession of the ball? So there's a dichotomy there. The other one is, instead of taking a high risk pass, you attempt to dribble by a person in a particular area of the field, or you try to dribble into two defenders and try to take on two defenders. And these are high risk actions, particularly if that is not part of your skill set. So for instance, if we want to give a very clear example, if you're a central defender and you're in your defensive third, a low soccer IQ or poor game intelligence would be that this defender is regularly trying to dribble by people in his defensive third to break pressure or whatever. That's low soccer IQ. You know, that's generally not what a central defender should be doing. Generally, a central defender should be a high possession retention rate, you know, probably the highest on the field, maybe after the goalkeeper, maybe ahead of the goalkeeper. So a high percentage pass completion percentage is required of a central defender. So you pass laterally, or you maybe even break lines, which would be high risk. But if you have that in your tool chest, then something like that, John. So please don't dribble in your own defensive third if you're a center back. That's a sign of low soccer IQ. I'm using an extreme example there just to illustrate the point.
Should players never take high risks, or should they never take risks with the ball?
You know what? Can you hold on to that question real quick? Don't forget it. I wanted to make another point here as to why retention of possession is so fundamental. And it doesn't necessarily have to do with my taste in football or my subjective look at football necessarily. And I want to illustrate this through another sort of example. Imagine if you have two teams and they're going to play against each other. Team A is vastly superior than Team B, vastly superior. And if we want to use a domestic example, let's talk about maybe Bob Bradley's LAFC, just to give some kudos there, okay? If Bob Bradley's LAFC is going to play against a lowly NAIA college team, what will naturally happen in that match is that LAFC will have an overwhelming amount of possession. Now, why is that? You know, why wouldn't it be more even, or why would LAFC's team and its individual players not just bunker down, or, you know, always play high risk, take high risk individual actions? Why is it that they would retain so much possession? Well, because it's a fundamental component of the game. I think it brings out a crucial essence to the game, that possession is correlated with a high level of play, okay? And if possession is correlated with a high level of play, which I think we all agree LAFC is a higher level of play than this NAIA college team, then it is also correlated with a high soccer IQ of its individual players. So the correct decision, by and large, is for each of those players on LAFC, and what they will be doing is retaining possession of the ball. So again, we're getting down to the core essence of the game through an extreme example like that. And if you go up the higher levels of the game, extended away from LAFC, and you go to the FC Barcelona's and the Man City's, et cetera, this is regularly the case when they confront themselves with inferior opposition. They, just by the nature of the game itself, they will have most of the possession. So high soccer IQ, top level players are correlated with the retention of possession.
I want to go back to the question I just asked, but now I want to add a little bit to it, because you've used the word regularly a couple times now in describing this. And that reminded me of what we've talked about before in a player being consistent. So is making these decisions consistently a better way to describe this rather than saying that they should never make these high risk decisions, or if a player is consistently making high risk decisions or actions, you know, then that kind of gives proof that the player is low soccer IQ. But if a player is consistently making good decisions or decisions that retain possession of the ball, that's proof that there could potentially be a high soccer IQ.
Yeah, I think that's pretty well put. I would only change that it's evidence instead of proof. I think proof is a far more stringent requirement, right? But it's evidentiary of high versus low soccer IQ. But it's all context based, right, John? How consistent should the player be in each of his or her possessions to keep possession versus taking a high risk action? So, for instance, going back to our center back example, if you're a center back and you have, I'm just going to make the numbers even here. If you have 100 touches of the ball in a game, I don't know, I would say that 90 of those 100 should probably be meant with the intent of retaining possession in a low risk sort of way. Meaning you're always connecting the simple, safe passes, particularly if you're in the defensive third. And then, I don't know, maybe 10%. These are things that I haven't quantified. I haven't studied the game and taken statistics for myself. Maybe 10 out of 100 times, you're trying more high-risk sort of activities, such as breaking of lines, where the lines are very congested, you know, and it requires a high degree of technical ability to break the line. Another high risk action for the center back would be, and high risk again is, you know, potentially losing possession. That's all. Another example could be launching a 40, 45 yard, you know, long ball over the air to one of the wingers. That requires a lot of technical ability, and the risk associated with losing possession is higher than connecting with your other center back. But these are things that they should definitely have in their repertoire and they should be utilizing, but it depends on the context. Are you in the defensive third? Are you in the middle third? Where is the player located? What is the score line? Are you winning 1-0, 2-0, 3-0, 4-0? In which case, maybe you can take some more liberties in that regard. Are you losing 0-1, 0-2, 0-3? And what is demanded of you? Are you supposed to, you know, try to dribble out of your defensive third when you're doing that? So there's so many situations to consider. But again, generally speaking, consistently speaking, in your words, you should try to retain possession. If you're a midfielder, the freedom to take risks is greater than if you're a center back. And then if you're a striker or a winger, the freedom to take risks is even higher because you're usually operating in the offensive third. And that is where a whole ton of improvisation and creativity is required of you. So you should be trying stuff to unbalance the opponent. So it's very context dependent, I guess, is my point. But generally speaking, every position on the field, they should be focusing on keeping possession of the ball more often than taking a high risk action.
One of the pieces of evidence, I guess, that has been passed around over the years, and I don't think it's used in any type of negative way, but I've seen statistics that Messi has one of the higher turnover rates, but he's also in a position, and then he's also defended in a way that, you know, he has to basically take risks quite often, and he's that type of player. And his, you know, pass completion rate in the final third, while, you know, he's done amazing things, he's not perfect by any means. And you know, the amount of times that he gets the ball at his feet and tries to do something remarkable is incredibly high as well. And then he happens to have some of the best connections and footwork and passing abilities. But like I said, he's not perfect. So yeah, there's been that statistic floating around of, you know, him having one of the higher turnover rates. And I think it's just La Liga, but maybe just in general. I don't know if that sparks any thought to you.
It does. And again, it's part of the context, some of which you just described. And the other part of the context is, well, this is a player with outrageous ability to be successful or more successful in these high risk propositions than another player. So the probability of him turning and dribbling by two defenders successfully, that probability is much higher than, I don't know, Rakitic turning and dribbling by two defenders, or any other winger, striker, false nine turning and dribbling by two defenders. So, you know, we afford Messi that greater freedom to do those things, because the risk versus reward is a lot lower, right? When he tries it. I mean, the risk is a lot lower versus if somebody else tries it. So that's another contextual piece of the puzzle. If you are, I don't know, a tremendously gifted dribbler in central midfield, you should also be afforded more freedoms, more risk-taking than if you are not a gifted dribbler. Busquets should not be trying to dribble by people in midfield, you know, versus, I don't know, somebody else. Name who you want, Luka Modric, you know, in central midfield. Yeah, go for it. Take on some players. We got you. So it's the ability of the player that comes into play a heck of a lot more. If you want to come, you know, make it more domestic, we can come up with domestic examples if you like. Sometimes I, you know, scratch my head if you see somebody like, I don't know, Jassy Sardis or Jordan Morris or Christian Roldan or something like this, you know, trying to take on two defenders that are in front of them when there's an easy, you know, pass to a winger, you know, that could launch a better attack for their respective teams. These are the sorts of things that drive me crazy watching MLS and historically the U.S. men's national team. With a lot of the player selections that they make, these players make a lot of bad decisions, you know, such as the one I just described. And it drives me nuts, John. So I think we just have, generally speaking, the players that we pick here are not that high on the soccer IQ scale. And I think that harms our teams domestically, and it harms the probability of our individual players having success overseas when they do attempt it.
Now, you mentioned your frustration with the players that are selected. You mentioned a couple names as well, and saying that the U.S. men's national team selecting these players consistently over the course of, you know, decades, and Major League Soccer doing pretty much the same, selecting players with these low soccer IQs historically for decades. These players never seem to change and improve their soccer IQ, like once they're part of a Major League Soccer team or once they're part of a U.S. men's national team. Is soccer IQ something that you can you know, change once you are a fully developed player, or is this something that has to be, you know, develop or part of the development process or part of the full development process? So it's something you have to start at a much younger age. Where does this soccer IQ begin and end?
Yeah, no, the second thing that you said, it has to be integrated in the full development process from a young age in order for a particular player to, you know, maximize their potential and maximize their ceiling. If these sorts of decision-making, if this sort of decision-making training, if you want to call it a training, isn't there from an early age and only starts being taught potentially at age 16, 18, 21 years of age, then while you can improve, you're so far behind your global counterparts who have received this soccer IQ or game intelligence training from age 9 that you'll never catch up to them, you know, because they continue getting better and you're just behind, John. So your ceiling is always going to be lower than what it could have been. It also drives me nuts, you know, when I hear the fan base or even practitioners in our own country state things such as, oh, he's still young, he's only 19 or 20 or whatever, you know, that sort of stuff we can teach later and the player will still be able to maximize, you know, what they ultimately could become. And I just think it's flat out wrong because so many bad habits have already been ingrained in the brain. The neurons have been wired a particular way, and to unwire them becomes very difficult at those ages. I'll give you an example or a thought example anyways. Let's say that a player in, let's talk about our center back. Okay. Actually, let's talk about him in the midfield. Let's say we have a central midfielder and from ages 9 to 16 throughout their youth career, they weren't really corrected. They were allowed to dribble whenever they wanted, as much as they wanted and wherever on the field they wanted. Well, consider this, that central midfield player from 9 to 16 never really was learning how to scan the field before receiving a pass in order to make a decision as to where his next pass is going to go. If he's going to one touch it to his winger, if he's going to one touch it to his striker, which seems to be open or there's an opportunity there, if he's going to one touch or two touch it to his left or right midfielder. These are things that the central midfielder is not thinking about if all he's ever done and been allowed to do is dribble. You know, all he's thinking about is give me the ball and then I'm going to turn or receive and I'm just going to dribble forward. So by the time you're 16, when a coach or somebody else is trying to correct this behavior or augment his dribbling ability with passing ability, well, the player's never developed the neural wiring for that. And it's very difficult for them to do. And I'm not saying this just from a theoretical standpoint. I'm saying it because I've seen players for 20 years now who fit the example that I'm just now describing to you, and they never recover. They never turn into what they could have turned into, which is a fantastic central midfielder that has all the tools in his arsenal. They just blindly receive the ball and blindly take an action after receiving the ball, it's too late.
Maybe a quick question about, you know, how soccer IQ is trained or is developed. Is it something that a coach like designs a session around? Like, is the coach showing up on a Tuesday saying, "Today we're going to work on soccer IQ," or is it something different? Is it more like implicit? You know, the coach over long periods of time is going to be selecting exercises and asking the team to play a certain style of play. And through that, a player develops a better IQ.
Okay, so two things. One, in the beginning of the episode, we discussed how important possession is and how possession is correlated with high level of play. And how, since it's correlated with higher level of play, possession is correlated with soccer IQ because the individual players have to know how to retain possession. So that out of the way, how do we train these things? Well, we train these things via patterns. So in the training grounds, you create these patterns of play, which are foundational and show up at the highest levels of the game all the time. So for instance, if you're, to start building out of the back, if you're the central midfielder now, you know how to find the space or lose your man to receive a ball from your back line or from your keeper. And then you also know that in this pattern, as we're training it, that you have options. The options are either you one touch your outside back once you receive it, or you one touch your winger, or you two touch, you turn on your first touch, and then on your next touch you do a give and go with your striker, your other central midfielder. So you have a variety of patterns that you train every week. And what that does for the player, it gives the player options to then consider on the weekend during match time. The option is, hey, I can get the ball and dribble it, for instance, if I have space and I can attack that space. Option number two is, we're going to execute this pattern of play because clearly I see it developing. Option three is, no, we're going to execute this other pattern of play because I see that developing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So he's armed with at least half a dozen options instead of, the bad habit that I just finished describing moments ago, where these things were not trained and the player was just allowed to do whatever the hell they wanted. And in our example, what the player wanted to do was dribble all the time.
And when you talk about habits, good and bad habits, I think of habits happening without having to put much thought into them, which in a way kind of frees up your mind to start thinking about some other things, maybe creatively, or solving a problem differently than, if a situation presents something, different, I guess. But I don't know if that plays into it at all, like the habit forming or the habit building part of this. And then also, like, I think tying that to the consistency aspect as well.
Well, yeah, I think we discussed it. Maybe you're just framing it differently with regards to habits. If the player is always allowed to dribble, that's a habit and they don't develop all the other optionality, versus the player who's developed, the habit of always scanning the field and seeing these patterns of play and whether they're developing or not developing, such that they know what actions to take or what option, particular action spaces there are, then that's a habit. Obviously, the one I just described is the one that describes a high-level player.
I want to try to arm people, especially parents and coaches and trainers as well, and even players, if players decide to listen to this, with maybe some examples of who is a good example of a high soccer IQ. And is that just a player? Is it teams? Is it coaches? Who can a parent sit down and watch with their kid in order to help them see a good example of a soccer IQ?
Well, Jesus, I don't know. Well, I'm a big Barcelona fan my entire life, and the Spanish football team. Those two examples historically, the past, 10 years or so have been, canonical cases of soccer IQ. So the Xavi, the Iniesta, the Busquets, that's in the midfield. And then the typical back line, Jordi Alba, Dani Alves, Piqué, go down the entire roster and they all exhibit high soccer IQ. Otherwise they wouldn't be on those teams or on that team. Just go to the, basically in general speaking, who are the top clubs in the world, top teams in the world, and just study each one of their players in each their respective positions. They're all high soccer IQ.
Yeah, I guess I want to try to find a way to, is there a way for a parent and player to kind of sit together and study a game, or what should they be looking for? Maybe asking who was the wrong question, but what should they be looking for? Maybe is the better question.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a hard question. I don't quite know how to answer it. All I can say is that I think, generally speaking, when we're all watching a soccer match on TV and you're watching the ball carrier, the player in possession, I think we all kind of play along in our minds and we're like, oh, this is what you should do next, because we clearly have a satellite view of everything. We see who is open, who's not open, who's making a run, who's not making a run. And I think generally speaking, us as fans watching the game, we get it correct a lot of the times. And so if the player is actually executing what you see or what you think the player should execute next in terms of retaining possession and making good decisions, then that could potentially be a high soccer IQ player. If the player all of a sudden doesn't pass it to the wide open player who's in a good position to go on the attack and instead, I don't know, dribbles into two guys or tries to do something risky in a risky area of the field, then that's a bad decision. I don't know, John, how else to answer that or give a different angle aside from maybe just focusing on one player instead of just watching an entire match for entertainment purposes. Just pick one player and follow that one player around and make note of all their possessions and how well or how poorly.
Yeah, two thoughts come to mind, and one of them is something that you've mentioned about yours and your brother's past and how you guys studied games and how you guys would record games, pause, rewind, fast forward, rewind, slow things down and just watch the different actions. So, you know, that came to mind again as, you know, a way to kind of study, you know, a player or a team and how you can learn to see if, you know, these decisions are good decisions or bad decisions. So that popped into my head. And then another thing that popped in my head was when you mentioned a different angle possibly. And this is something that coaches and parents can maybe be armed with and players as well when they're, you know, on the field with their teammates or maybe they're on the bench watching the game or for whatever reason. But, you know, if a parent is on the sideline or if a coach is on the sideline and they're trying to determine if a team or if a player is good or bad, you can kind of look at why the possession broke down in different situations. So did a player make a high risk decision? Did they make the wrong decision? Are they consistently making the wrong decision? So there's just kind of just a different way to watch the game from a sideline on a Saturday or Sunday, I think is one way that it can be framed.
Well said. I couldn't have said it better myself, John. That's good.
Yeah, and then just one last topic to kind of touch on before we go is where do all these high risk, you know, dribbling moves and passes and everything kind of fit into this puzzle, and how can a coach or a trainer or a parent help their player develop not only a high soccer IQ but also still develop like these special skills, like the, you know, how to hit a 40 yard ball on a dime, how to slalom through players. Like where does that all fit into this?
Let's talk about this central midfielder, because that's what we've been talking about the whole time, this theoretical central midfielder always dribbling versus not always dribbling, meaning low soccer IQ versus high soccer IQ. And it all comes back to their particular ability. If their ability is not that of a dribbler, they're not that good at it, then they should do less of it in actual matches until they become better at it. So if they're not going to practice it like crazy in real matches, they should be doing it in pickup games. And that is what Brazil, Argentina, South America, France, you know, all of these top level professionals, they came out of an environment where pickup soccer was a huge healthy portion of their development diet. And that is the arena in which you try all of these high risk things that maybe you don't have the ability for, but you want to develop the ability for. That is where you do all these line splitting passes. That is where you try rainbows, or you try to do all these crazy step overs or dribble by two guys or whatever, because whatever, you're playing pickup soccer and it's for fun, but that is the development arena to do these sorts of things that in the real game context don't really happen all that frequently because they're not the right decisions to make. You know, Neymar has tremendous ability to do these step overs and all this stuff and retain possession and successfully execute it. But if you're not Neymar, well, you shouldn't be doing that on the field. If you're doing that, trying to be Neymar on the field, and you don't have Neymar's ability, well, guess what's going to happen to you? You're not going to go very far in this game because the coach isn't going to like that. They're going to bench you, and nobody's going to recruit you or want to make you a professional if that is what you're doing every one of your possessions when you don't have the ability. To go develop the ability in pickup games, get it to the point where you can do some of those things during the match, and then you will be given the green light to do some of those things in the matches. So pickup games is the answer to your question, man.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll be talking about pickup games here in the very near future, so that'll be a different episode.
Yeah.
All right, was there anything else that we needed to cover regarding Soccer IQ?
I think we made our point.
Yeah, I think so. Our flagship program helps coaches and trainers discern what is good for their teams and for their players. But now we've created a program for parents. Because parents, you are personal trainers too. Yep, that's right. And in order to properly mentor your player, you need to know what's good and what's not. Just like coaches, you and your player are flooded with thousands of training videos on YouTube and Instagram. But most of them are a waste of time because they aren't relevant. They don't translate to the real game. And figuring out what does and what doesn't, and why, is just flat out difficult, especially if you don't have a background in soccer to lean on. So we've taken Brian Kleiben's more than 20 years of experience working with teams and individual players, from U9 to U19, and extracted valuable lessons that can help you navigate the minefield that is American youth soccer. But this isn't just about drills. That's only a small fraction of it. And to be honest, you can get drills anywhere. What you're getting with the 343 Masterclass are the cultural lessons and an education in philosophy that other trainers and courses don't offer. It's these elements that can help you understand the landscape, read the game on and off the field, and translate everything into real development for your player. Right now, you can get on the list for the 343 Masterclass. We are currently rolling it out little by little to small groups. To reserve your spot, go to 343masterclass.com. All right, thank you for listening. Do you have a question about the topic that we covered in this episode? If so, we'd love to hear from you, and we will be answering some of your questions at the end of next week's episode. Submit your questions on Twitter or head to 343coaching.com to leave your question in the comment section. Make sure that you are subscribed to 343 FM on your favorite podcasting app. The show is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and many more platforms. And if you're feeling super generous, we'd love it if you dropped us a 5-star rating or a review. And don't forget that you can find our entire library of podcast episodes, over 200 written articles, and our online courses that help accelerate the development of coaches and players using methods that have been proven to work here in the United States. Once again, all of that can be found at 343coaching.com. All right. Thank you so much for listening. We will catch you next time here on the 343 Podcast.